No, there's a U.S. Women's World Cup game getting started here shortly, so I appreciate everybody making the time. My name's Rob Ring. I'm the Chief Science Officer at Autism Speaks, and on behalf of my foundation, who are helping to sponsor the event, it's a real pleasure to help introduce this really fantastic conversation that's teed up here. I think you look across many of the both formal and informal conversations we've had throughout the last 2 days. Precision medicine is a theme that continues to pull together so many disparate topics, from big data to genomic discovery. It's really become a very large surface area for discussion out there across many different disciplines. And I don't think we could have a better set of individuals to drive a conversation to help flesh some of this out and the importance of it. So with that, I'd like to introduce Judy Woodruff, who will be introducing and then moderating a discussion with Francis Collins, the director of the NIH. Off to you guys.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I am delighted to be here. It is late in the day. I didn't know the women were playing. Had I known, maybe Francis and I wouldn't have agreed to do this.
Yeah, what were we thinking?
But what a great topic to talk about, and what a treat to be able to talk to Dr. Collins about it. The subject from bench to bedside, how precision medicine is changing the future. I'm sure everyone, if you've come to this, you know what it is, the relatively new concept of factoring in individual variability in genes, in the environment, and lifestyle in order to custom tailor treatment. And there is literally no one in a better position to talk about it. The individual who is charged with the responsibility of implementing the President's Precision Medicine Initiative, which came out in January of this year, than the head of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Francis Collins. So I want to just plunge right in, Dr. Collins, and first of all, tell us, I mean, I said everybody here knows what it is, but let's back up. What really is it? Where did it come from?
Well, let's be clear that we have been practicing some form of precision medicine for a while. It's not a completely new concept. If you go to the eye doctor and get your eyes checked out and you need a new pair of glasses, you kind of want those to be precisely prepared for you. You don't want some generic pair of spectacles. You can get those at the drugstore, but that's probably not what you want. Similarly, if you need a blood transfusion, you are probably pretty interested in knowing that they've done the right thing about that typing and crossing so that the blood you're getting is going to work for you and you won't have a transfusion reaction. So in a certain way, we have been trying to individualize our approach to medicine for a long time. But unfortunately, in many situations, we just haven't had the information we need to do it. So to be honest, I'm a physician. I would say most of the time, a doctor who has to take care of a patient who has a particular problem or is trying to give advice about how to maintain wellness is kind of giving the average recommendation for the average person in that situation. The individual is not necessarily being considered. Even though we'd like to do that, in many instances, we just don't have the information to do so. So precision medicine is trying to turn the page and say, let's really focus on the differences between us that matter. And some people think, well, it's all about your DNA, and that's in there for sure. We'll talk about how having your complete genome sequenced might be something you'd want to do and to have in your medical record. But that's not the whole thing. It's nature, it's nurture, it's your own health behavior decisions. It's your environmental exposures. It's your diet, it's your exercise. All of those things sort of feeding together into this outcome, which might be health or it might be illness. The goal here is really quite bold, to try to see, could we actually, in this moment in history where a lot of technology has come along that wasn't there before, to actually do this on a large scale, find out what works, and transform as much of medicine as we can into this more precision-minded approach so that when you go to the doctor, you're not getting that one-size-fits-all recommendation. You're getting something that takes much more account of you and how you may be different than the last person who walked into that doctor's office.
So the technology is really what's triggered
this. It's huge. I will say some of us have been dreaming about this for a while. I even wrote a paper in 2004, 11 years ago, in a journal called Nature, sort of saying it's time to have a precision medicine strategy for the United States, and we need to enroll a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people, in a research study where you could begin to collect this information, see how it works. It landed with a total thud. I mean, people looked at it and said, are you really dreaming here? There's no way you could do that at the present time. In 2004, you couldn't afford it. The cost of doing DNA analysis was many magnitude, orders of magnitude more than it is now. And we didn't have electronic health records for most people then either. As much as we all sort of look at electronic health records and know that they have serious issues, they're not perfect, they're not interoperable, we have issues that we need to work on, they have arrived for many people. And most hospitals now have them, and many doctors do as well. And there's a wealth of research opportunities in that space because it's a way of collecting information on people who are willing to have you look. This has got to be appropriately dealing with privacy. So you put together genomics, right. You put together electronic health records, and genomics, by the way, your DNA sequence can be done now for a couple $1,000s instead of millions or hundreds of millions. You put together various environmental sensors that are getting much better at detecting what's in your immediate environment as far as the air, the water, the food. We put together a lot of the wearable sensors that monitor your health behaviors. I'm wearing a couple of
Speaking
them, in
of which,
fact.
Yeah. Tell them what you're wearing.
Okay, I can't advertise for anything here. So I have one that monitors basically exercise, the number of steps. It monitors sleep. The other is a watch that actually is pretty good at measuring pulse. I did a little bike ride this afternoon. I wanted to make sure I was pushing so I can be pushing along and see exactly what is my pulse. I was going about 145. That seemed pretty good going up that hill. And it records it. It sends it back to my computer. I can therefore look over the course of time how I'm doing. At my house, I have a scale. When I stand on it, it sends the weight to my computer laptop so I can't pretend it wasn't what it was. And it's always tempting to do that, believe me. So all of those things give us the opportunity, I think, for a positive feedback loop for people to maintain their health that we haven't had before, but we're not quite sure which gadgets work, which gadgets don't work. We have a chance now to find that out. Put this all together. And it's not now just about let's find sick people and try to see if we can make them better. It's also let's find healthy people and figure out how to keep them healthy, which we haven't done enough of.
Right. And let's talk about how you've organized, because you're not just saying, okay, we're going to do precision medicine. This has been organized into two separate tracks here that NIH is pursuing.
Yeah, let me tell you about that. And again, this got unveiled in the State of the Union message when the president spoke exactly two sentences about precision medicine, but you could tell something was going on there, and you could see the people in the chamber sort of looking at each other like, well, what is that? Should we stand up? Should we not stand up? They all stood up. It sounded good. And then 10 days later, it was sort of clearer what this was with a much more detailed explanation of what we're trying to do. And you're right, it is two connected but distinct efforts. First part, which is focused on a much more immediate need and an opportunity, is focused specifically on cancer. Cancer is the place where precision medicine right now is in the most exciting and forward-looking space. And if any of you heard some of the cancer presentations today, you know what I'm talking about. Because cancer is, after all, a disease that happens after environmental exposures or heredity or who knows, but it comes about because of mistakes in DNA. So that cancer cells have an instruction book that's got glitches in it that's causing those cells to grow when they shouldn't. That's what cancer is. Cells that should have stopped growing keep growing, and they spread to other places. We've known about that for a long time, sort of as a description. But only recently have we had the ability to look inside the cancer cell, read the entire instruction book of a malignant cell, and find out what's driving it. And it turns out there is a manageable, although long, list of ways that good cells go bad in terms of genes that would normally stop cell growth that get lost along the way. You can think of those sort of like the brakes in your car that just aren't there anymore. Or some genes that are supposed to promote cell growth, but they're supposed to stop, and they don't stop. Those are like the stuck accelerator. So we have those now pretty good ideas. But until very recently, if you developed cancer and you needed a treatment, the treatments you were getting, the chemotherapy, largely has been developed decades ago without being able to take advantage of this new information about these pathways that are involved. New therapies now coming along very rapidly, dozens and dozens of them, are in fact targeted to that approach. So, to get to what this precision medicine cancer part is all about, the idea is to try to greatly expand the ability to find individuals whose cancers could be understood on the basis of analyzing their DNA, and those might be adults, they might be kids, and then give them the opportunity to have this sort of targeted therapy in a research basis so we know exactly what works, even come to the situation where maybe it's not one drug, it's a combination of drugs, and monitor very carefully to see what happens so that we learn why it works when it works and why it doesn't work when it doesn't work. That's a bold precision medicine approach to cancer, which we are ready to do now. And I think, given the president's personal concern about cancer, given his own family and all of our concerns about this disease, this is such a great fit for the opportunity. We've right up to the moment ready to go there, and we should just do it.
But a couple of questions about that. I think I asked you this earlier. Why cancer? I mean, why not Alzheimer's? Why not diabetes? Why did you choose cancer stuff?
Cancer really is out there a little ahead of the other disorders that we want to apply precision medicine to. But maybe it's because we know more about the cancer cell and we know that what's driving it is this glitch in the instruction book. With Alzheimer's disease, which we are working on with incredible intensity right now, we don't know as much. It's not as clear how you would mount a major precision medicine approach to Alzheimer's. I'd like to get there. When we talk about the other part of this project, it may help us get there. But cancer is ready to go. It's ready to go now.
At the same time, we're told cancer is not one disease, it's many, many diseases.
Exactly.
So how does that factor into what you're trying?
Well, it totally fits because we've been treating cancers like one disease, although we usually sort of think of it as, well, it arose in a particular part of your body. Oh, you have prostate cancer, or you have breast cancer, or you have pancreatic cancer. It's turning out that where the cancer arose, in which organ, is a whole lot less important than what, when you stare closely at the DNA that those cancer cells have, what's driving them. And so it may be that somebody who has a lung cancer has more in common with somebody with a bladder cancer than two people with lung cancer. We are going to have to sort of blow away our so-called taxonomy of how we basically describe cancer, which has largely been anatomic, and replace that with a molecular understanding that has much more significance for therapeutics. And that's what people are really wanting to know. What's going to make me better?
So what's the timetable? Are you already enlisting people to be part of this, or where are you?
So we were charged by the president to have this ready to start in the fall of this year. So we have been frantically, since January, convening all of the experts to shape the design of this program, both for cancer and for this other large-scale national cohort study that I'll describe in a minute. But the goal is to get this going in the next few months.
So you're already reaching out to find people who will participate? Is that right?
So the cancer part of this would proceed by making cancer clinical trials available even more broadly than ever before across the country and in something like 2,400 different sites so that the physicians who are working in those particular cancer centers would have the ability to enroll somebody who's interested in this kind of a research program. Now, it is research. We don't know a lot of these answers. That's why we're doing this. But it does seem like the moment has come to find that out. And I got to say, you can now, if you walk through a cancer clinic or talk to physicians who take care of patients with cancer and ask them, tell me a story of something that really surprised you. All of them will come up with stories of people who had far advanced malignancy where it was pretty much looking like this is not going to work, and yet one of these new targeted therapies got tried, and a patient who was basically resigned to having the end come quickly gets better and goes back to work. I mean, we even are referring to this as a Lazarus situation, which is probably a little too dramatic. That is what keeps us particularly excited and inspired. We're on the right path here. The problem is many of those remarkable experiences don't end up being durable. There's a remission, a complete absence of disease, but maybe a year or two later it comes back. We have to figure out how to keep that from happening. The other thing I must say in cancer, and again, I'm sure this was talked about today, that has just come out of many decades of work, but it was sputtering along, and now all of a sudden it has burst forth with such power, is harnessing the immune system. Because our immune systems are probably fighting off cancers every day. Cells that got a little out of line, the immune system goes, oh, no, you don't, and that's it, and you never know that that was happening. Why is it then that cancers ever manage to take over? What blocked the immune system? And what we're learning is cancer cells are diabolically clever. They actually have the ability to shut down the immune response and protect themselves against this. But now we have understood what those molecules are that are involved in that shutdown, and we have figured out how to get around that with monoclonal antibodies that have just come out in the last couple of years. And for leukemias and lymphomas, this has been an amazing turnaround for lots of these situations where we really had run out of options, and increasingly now for other cancers as well. So if one were to get involved in this kind of cancer precision medicine effort, your cancer would get details determined about it, and then an assessment of what's driving that cancer would be made, and then a choice based on that personal precision information about you. What of the menu of cancer therapeutics would make the most sense for you? And that's what then you would be tried on. And if it didn't work, they'd already know a lot about you and they'd flip to the next option and not just say, oh, well, I guess we're done here.
Well, let's talk about, we can come back to some of that, but let's talk about the other track, which, as you said earlier, involves looking not just at sick people, but how people stay healthy.
Yes. And this is about every disease. We really want to understand diabetes and Alzheimer's. We want to understand autism. We want to know what it is that makes people have heart attacks. And we know a fair amount about all those things, but we don't know nearly enough. And if we really want to understand what are the factors that play out in health and disease, you need very large numbers of individuals, and you need a lot of information about all of them, because we're complicated. And the idea that you can sort this out by studying a few people doesn't seem to give you the answers that you need. So here's the dream, that we would enroll 1 million or more participants, volunteers, in this project, that they would, and they would be across all ages and genders, they would be across socioeconomic groups and ethnicity, they would be geographically distributed. This would not be a perfect snapshot of the country, but it was going to have lots of different groups represented.
Larger than your typical trial.
Massively larger. Group. Yeah, nobody has ever contemplated a trial of this sort where you're actually going to be collecting this much data, and this is a big data issue for sure. You would ask those individuals to make it their electronic health records available for qualified researchers to be able to see what medical experiences they have had, what drugs they have been taking, what medical claims have been made. We would ask them also to consider enrolling in parts of this that would involve the wearable sensors, like the ones we were talking about, to see what kind of data can be collected and how they would use that. And we would ultimately expect that they would volunteer to have their complete DNA genome sequenced, all 6 billion letters of their code, and done at a very high quality. Right now, we can't quite afford that for the $200 million that is in the president's budget and that the Congress has just embraced. Just in the last few days. Yeah. But over the course of 4 or 5 years, that cost keeps coming down. We think we could get to that point. Now, you might say, why would people want to do this? Well, I would say a couple of reasons. One is they will get information back. If you were involved, you'd be getting things fed back about yourself that probably wouldn't be apparent to you if you were just in the standard of medical care. But I think also a lot of people are just interested in taking part in this kind of a historic national moment where we're really going to figure out what is involved in health and disease. I think that from what I've heard from lots of people, they will say, sign me up. Now, how do you sign up? Now, there is an issue here about cost. Yes, there's always an issue about cost. And the way we think we could put together a lot of this, which will save a fair amount of the cost, is by asking those institutions that have already established these kinds of large-scale studies. We call them cohorts. To say, would you like to participate? And we'll just glue these together and make a much larger whole than the sum of the parts. So, for instance, the Mayo folks are out there. Mayo Clinic has such a cohort. They're very interested in this. Marshfield Clinic, Geisinger Clinic, Kaiser Permanente, Intermountain. We're here in Colorado. Anybody who lives here probably has care through Intermountain. That also has a cohort of this sort. The Veterans Administration has a veterans program with 400 vets that are already signed up, and half of them have already had DNA analysis done. But it could be so much better.
But you're looking for healthy people to study,
yes.
Is that right?
Well, both. I mean, we're looking for healthy people, for people who already have a chronic illness. It's a cross-section of our nation. And we're looking for people who are healthy now but maybe are at risk for illness to try to see, well, what are the predictors of whether that actually happens, and are there ways that we could prevent that?
What does it tell you at the end of this? I mean,
what do you get out of this anyway?
What do you referred to the cost several times, and I want to ask you about that. But what do you come away understanding at the end of this? I mean, we're talking years, years of trials.
And some will come sooner, and some will take a while. Let me give you some examples. So one area that we will probably learn about, I think probably in the first few years, is areas of medicine where we really don't diagnose conditions on the basis of the information that we might be able to feed into it. Take mental health. If you look at the diagnosis called schizophrenia, it is a very symptom-based. There's not really a gold standard to kind of figure out, is this person in that category or not? We are increasingly learning that there are factors, both environmental and genetic, 108 genetic factors recently identified for schizophrenia, that are beginning to make some molecular sense out of the pathways that are involved. And it looks as if, for instance, that not everybody who's got the diagnosis of schizophrenia has the same brain condition. We may be able to separate this out. Schizophrenia is a very common disease. Depression is a very common disease. All the mental illnesses that are common in the population, we're going to have lots and lots of individuals in a million strong cohort to begin to say, okay, with all the data in front of you, maybe we ought to completely reorganize our diagnostic criteria. And I think we could probably imagine that will happen. That would be one thing. It's more of a, you could say, a start point down the path to doing something better about prevention and treatment. But if we can't even figure out the diagnostic criteria, it's pretty hard to go on to those next steps.
So if somebody said, so what's your dream, Francis Collins, coming out of this, it would be better diagnostics?
That would be one. But let me mention some others that are maybe even more immediately sort of clinical benefit. If you look at a million people and you look at their complete DNA, you're going to find some very surprising things, because we are all 99.9% the same, but 0.1% is still a lot of DNA. We know, for instance, that all of us are walking around with 60 to 100 new mutations in our genomes that our parents didn't have, because mistakes get made in passing DNA from parent to child. And sometimes those are in vulnerable places, and that is, in fact, a contributor to birth defects we're just beginning to understand. But sometimes those new mutations can actually be good for you. So we're interested in finding people whose DNA says you really should be sick, but you're not. Right now, we have no way of finding those people. They wouldn't get their DNA analyzed. They're doing fine. But there's a good chance that there are people in a million where you'd learn something of that sort. Let me give you an example, which has led to probably one of the biggest races for a new drug on the market in a while, and this one is for cholesterol. There is a gene called PCSK9, which is we don't name genes in a very friendly way, do we? We should have called it something you could pronounce. Well, PCSK9 came to light because there are people whose cholesterol is prodigiously low, I mean really low, and you start to wonder, well, what's that about? And it turns out they have a loss of function of this gene. It turns out there are even rare people, you have two copies of this gene, because you get one from mom, one from dad. There are rare people where both copies aren't working. So it's completely missing. Those people have cholesterols that are like 12. And what's more, they seem to be almost entirely protected against cardiovascular disease. They don't get heart attacks. They don't get strokes. You might wonder what else happens to them that's bad. As far as we can tell, they're fine. The rare people we've encountered, one of them's a physical therapist. They're very active. They seem totally normal. So think about that, what I just told you. And now you're a drug company, and you want to make the next drug that is going to lower cholesterol in people where statins don't seem to be working. Ha! Nature has just given you a gift here, because PCSK9, or whatever it does, seems to be something that if you could block it, you would drop cholesterol, and you shouldn't make people sick, because there are people walking around with no PCSK9, and they are fine. It's perfect sort of kind of model for deciding to make an investment in that as a drug. And in fact, three companies are racing each other right now to get over the finish line. The FDA is, in fact, reviewing those this year. And this will be, I think, for the management of cholesterol, the biggest advance since statins, all because of a genetic discovery. Now, there's lots more of those out there, but we haven't had this large cohort of people to go looking to find them.
So that could make a difference soon.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that could be in the near term.
We need to get, of course, all those genome sequences. And, of course, it's a long path from having the idea, oh, that's a good drug target, to having the FDA approve it. But it gets you on a path that you're much more confident is going to work, as opposed to most drug development programs, which don't.
How quickly, say you start learning things from these trials.
Yeah.
How does that get translated into a physician's office somewhere? How long does that take?
One of the things that I think would happen fairly quickly relates to getting the right drug at the right dose for the right person at the right time. We call this pharmacogenomics, which is way too many syllables, but let me explain. If somebody walks into the office and has a particular condition that normally requires a drug therapy to make you better, let's say you have a cardiac condition or you need a blood thinner, the usual thing the doctor does is make the best guess of what would be the right drug for you. But again, this is one size fits all. We now know for more than 100 drugs that there are genetic variations that are predictive of whether that drug is going to be too much for you or too little or maybe the wrong drug altogether. But we don't use that information. We don't use it because right now it's just not practical. The doc wants to write the prescription. There's no time to like do a DNA test, which right now means sending a blood sample off to some other lab and waiting 2 weeks. So we're just not using this. But if we had, in this million-strong cohort, the DNA sequence has already been done up front. It's sitting in the medical record, and now the doc can go, oh, well, maybe you need to have half the usual dose because I just clicked my mouse, and you have that variant that says the regular dose is too much for you. We could really test out this idea. And considering the number of people every year who suffer adverse drug reactions, we could make a substantial dent in that with information we already have. So that could happen pretty quick.
How does it get out to physicians, to individual patients?
So one of the things that I think is going to help with this million-strong effort is that many of the individuals who participate will be in healthcare delivery systems like the Kaisers or the Intermountains or the Geisingers, so that the physicians who are involved in the research are also the ones giving the health care. We have a terrible sort of track record, and that's probably what you're alluding to, Judy, that we learn that something actually works in a research study, and then it takes 20 years before it actually gets implemented in the practice of medicine. We ought to be able to shorten that loop substantially by the fact that the same people are involved. And that if we have, in fact, a million or more people whose care is already being improved by immediate access to research results, don't you think other healthcare delivery systems are going to look at this and go, gosh, if we're going to be competitive, maybe we need to start to do that too. I may be a little optimistic here, but I think that would be a driver that might help this otherwise really frustrating, long, slow process of incorporating new information.
Why has it taken so long?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. I have to say, because I'm a physician, physicians know what they know, and sometimes they're sure they know, even when the information they're working on is out of date. And physicians are enormously barraged by information coming from all kinds of directions, not all of which is correct, And so there's a bit of a seat of the pants thing going on, and many times the physician's instincts may not, in fact, be the ones that are undergirded by the facts. Physicians like myself are often influenced, maybe more than we should be, by their own experiences with a particular patient who had a condition and something happened. But that's an anecdote, and the plural of anecdotes is not data, and we need data if you're really seriously going to drive this process. What's going to help is that the quality effort in this country is going to insist that if you're going to get compensated, if you're going to get reimbursed, you have to be able to show that you're actually implementing things that matter. If you're taking care of patients with hypertension, you have to be able to show their blood pressure is controlled, because we know that matters.
You alluded to this a few minutes ago, but what about the disclosure aspects of this, the fact that people would be letting a big government entity have access to all their information? What are the safeguards? I mean, many of us have come to believe nothing is private anymore, but I mean, how have you been thinking about that? How are you going to address
it? It's a very serious question, and certainly the president's quite concerned that we address that in the most rigorous way possible, recognizing, as we have all learned, that there's probably no absolute guarantee. Since I'm one of those 16 million federal employees who the Chinese are now enjoying security records from, I can say there is no guarantee, even a system that ought to be impenetrable, that it might not happen. So I think what we will do, of course, is to be sure that participants in this study, and again, they're not patients, they're not subjects, they're participants. They're at the table. They're helping us design this. That they are aware that there is no absolute guarantee against some kind of intrusion. We will make sure that the data that's collected will be only accessible to researchers who are qualified, who explain what it is that they want to do with it. It needs to fit with what the consent was that those patients gave, and it needs to be overseen in a way that the data doesn't then leak out without oversight. And we have pretty good experiences doing this with smaller studies, so I think we know what the principles and the framework ought to be, but this is very large. Again, I think we can say with 99.9% certainty that we can set up a system that there will not be leaks from, unless somebody really takes a determined effort to try and see what they can do. And again, that is something that every participant has to sort of think about as a risk. We're always doing this, aren't we? It's a risk, it's a benefit. I think it'll be a benefit to be part of this cohort study, but there will be a small risk.
Do you have the funds? You talked about the funds that Congress approved a certain amount in the past few days. Do you have the funds you need to do this? You would save some if you coordinate with the other, if you work with these other groups you mentioned, like Mayo and the others who already have a body of people they're looking at.
And I particularly want to give credit to the VA, because this Million Veterans Program is probably the largest such study, and they've already invested a lot, and they have electronic health records and some DNA information on hundreds of thousands of people that was going to sort of make a really quick start on this whole effort. The president proposed $215 million in this coming fiscal year that starts October 1st. The Congress has embraced that, which was great to see. I mean, that doesn't happen all the time. I think this is not a partisan issue. This is an opportunity which I think almost everybody who's sort of heard about it kind of gets excited about. Wow, you could do that for cancer, and then you could build this national cohort, and this would have all of these consequences. Why wouldn't you want to do that? But, of course, that's the first year. If this is going to be successful, it's going to need to play out over many years. And it will probably need to grow from the budget that's there for this coming fiscal year to something a bit larger than that, not a huge amount larger than that. And in our system, it's very hard to make long-term plans. I am enormously gratified to see the enthusiasm about precision medicine, but it comes in the context of a pretty troubling 12-year slide in support for biomedical research, where NIH has lost now about 23% of our purchasing power since 2003, and this is a 23% down from where we were in 2003, which means the average investigator who's coming to us with their bright ideas from all of the institutions around this country where great science is being done, they have the worst chance in history of getting funded, down now to about 16%. Traditionally, it's been twice that. So we're leaving a lot of great science on the table. And I can understand then why some of them are going, well, how could you be starting this big, fancy new program when, in fact, the foundation of everything we do, which is the investigator-initiated hypothesis-driven science, is being so badly squeezed. And I totally resonate with that. At the same time, even though this sounds like a big effort, it is less than 1% of the NIH budget. And if it has inspired some enthusiasm, if it has gotten people who weren't paying that much attention to medical research to go, wow, you could do that, well, that helps the whole enterprise, I think.
Well, staying on the money, how many years was it that Congress didn't even approve a budget for the NIH?
Far too
they were
many.
Going on what we call continuing resolutions.
Yes.
How do you function? I mean, I'm going to broaden this out a little. How do you function in that environment
It's very frustrating. I mean, anybody who's in business would say the worst thing in business is uncertainty. Well, the worst thing in medical research is uncertainty. What we do with NIH support is this foundational work, understanding how life works and how disease happens, and we work as closely as we can with the private sector to be sure we have an ecosystem that has all of the right parts, and it does, but the ecosystem needs support, and that support has been dwindling. So it is incredibly frustrating, as you see, year after year loss of purchasing power. The biggest blow, of course, was sequestration, this really most stupid of all possible financial models for managing the government's budget. Everybody would agree with what I just said. It was the stupidest possible model. It was put in place so that there would have to be some other choice made so that this couldn't happen. It was a poison pill, but we all swallowed it, or Congress helped us, and NIH certainly swallowed it. We lost $1.5 billion on one day in March of 2013 because of sequester, and we've not been able to recover all of that since. So I'm having groused about that, and I just did, and I think it's justified.
And I gave you an opportunity to do that.
I would say the good news here is, looking at this year, I've been at NIH now for 22 years. I came there to run the Genome Project. I've been the NIH director for 6 years. I have never seen a time of more agreement on the Hill about the importance of turning this corner, about getting medical research back on a stable trajectory where those investigators that are about to give up can have some hope that there's actually a career path for them and they don't have to do something else or move to another country. Other countries, by the way, have continued to grow while we've been shrinking, and that ought to be something we'd worry about too. But when you see what the House did, proposing a $1.1 billion increase for NIH next year, what the Senate did, a $2 billion increase. There's lots of other aspects of those appropriations bills that make people very uneasy, and I'm sympathetic with that. But as far as medical research, we seem to have arrived at a point where everybody says, this is a good thing for the government to do. We've kind of squeezed this one too much. Let's try to see what we can do to put some of that back.
Can you quantify, though, I mean, I know you were trying to end on a positive note on that before we take a question, but can you quantify what wasn't happening, what hasn't been happening because those research dollars haven't been there for these bright young people and, who want to do this work?
Well, again, I think that the thing I worry about most is those bright young scientists, many of whom have spent years getting trained, going through college and graduate school and a postdoctoral training, and maybe now finally landing in an independent position with their own lab, many of them having waited years to get there. And yet now they're looking at the worst funding situation in history. They're sending their grants to NIH. They're getting back a response that says, well, we like this, but it only scored at the 20th percentile, and today we can only fund at the 15th, so try again. After trying again two or three times and getting that same response, they're about ready to give up. A recent survey said something like 20% of scientists, not just the young scientists, but the experienced ones as well, in the U.S. are seriously considering moving to another country.
Well, that was my question. What do they do? I mean, can they go to, I don't know, another research center? There's nothing like the NIH, but... Or do they go abroad? Do they go overseas to other...
I mean, some of them change careers. They do something else. They go to law school. They become investment bankers. I don't know. Some of them do leave the country. And we are particularly seeing a very significant exodus to China. China's reading our playbook from 1985 and saying, wow, look what the U.S. did that built their economy in a dramatic way. And the economists, I think, would agree with that. Why can't we do that, too? So China is increasing their support of medical research by double-digit percentages, year after year after year, compounding the increases, so that they are now able to offer to people in the U.S. who are in a very frustrated situation, here's $1 million, here's a beautiful lab, here's 10 different slots that you can recruit to, come on over. And many people are saying, well, yeah, why wouldn't I?
Okay, I want to ask you one more question before, but think of, if you have a question, raise your hand, and before I turn to you, Dr. Collins, do we view what China's doing as competition, or if they come up with a great answer about cancer that can be shared with everyone, that's also progress, isn't
it? That's absolutely true, and I'm glad you raised that point, because I don't want to come across in any way as saying, oh, well, we're the only ones that should be doing this. No, we celebrate the international collaborations, and they're very much part of what we're doing in cancer genomics. There's an international consortium. China's a big part of that. The Genome Project, China did a part of that as well. That's all great. As long as the data gets out there, is made accessible to everybody who can use it, and as long as we don't end up with an imbalance in terms of where the talent has to end up going. We do have to worry about also the economic impact. Last year, China filed more patents in life science than the United States did. Mm. That's never happened before, never even close. They're coming up so fast. And they understand, of course, that that's how you start small businesses. That's how you grow the economy. We are, of course, worried about our own economy, and yet we're losing, I think, some of our lead by the way in which we've squeezed the entrepreneurial attitudes of those young scientists that are coming up with great ideas, but right now not finding a way to pursue them.
Do you think there's a direct connection between the Chinese for the first time being ahead and the cutbacks?
I think, yeah. We have curves that are going in opposite direction. We're going like this, they're going like that. And you can see the consequences.
All right, questions right here. And we have a microphone. We're going to run around and bring it to you. Anybody with a question, raise your hand.
So just wanted to follow quickly on the last discussion around access and some of the trickiness that you have already encountered and will continue to encounter around security, privacy, et cetera. You know, at Autism Speaks, we have a very large genomics project.
Yes.
As you know, 10,000 genomes.
Yes.
Will be done by first quarter next year, and we're working with Google on this. And indeed, this legal, ethical front, if you will, is turning out to be, you know, one of the more tricky areas. The question I have sort of evolves past the idea that these cohorts, these databases, and the accessibility challenges you face with that are facing the research community. You know, how do we make the data more accessible to qualified researchers, level the playing field across the world? With our missing program, we actually are envisioning also how we make that data available to the families and the individuals who have consented to donate that DNA and are as much a part of this genomic discovery process as the researchers who are creating the value for
totally
it.
Totally agree.
So are you thinking in the context of PMI also looking at making the genomic data accessible to families and the actual participants in the research as well as the researchers themselves?
Yes. It's going to be interesting to figure out exactly, though, how to balance that desire, which I completely share, about disclosure, with the fact that an awful lot of the data is a very ambiguous nature, and we don't know what it means, and do you really benefit people by dumping things on them that is absolutely inscrutable? I think we need to hear more clearly from participants. We're having a workshop next Wednesday and Thursday exactly to talk about this issue. What is it that people value, and what would they just as soon say? Save that one until you know what it means. And maybe that's the answer, that you tell what you know now, but you expect you're going to learn more as you go along. There's this other tricky regulatory thing, which is that you're not, in the U.S. anyway, supposed to give genetic information to individuals if it's going to change clinical decision-making unless it's been done in what's called a CLIA-approved lab, which means that whatever laboratories are doing this work have to go through those kinds of very stiff standards, which adds to the cost substantially if you're doing a research project. So we have to figure out how to play that part as well and be consistent with the law.
So that line is still being figured out.
Still being figured out. And
what's
we need
okay
to, really,
to share and what isn't.
And this is another great example why we need the participants at the table, because the rest of us can come up with ideas that we think people want, but we'd much rather hear what they say.
Okay, there's a hand in the very back, and then there's several more over here. I'll try to get to everybody.
Hi, I was wondering if you were planning on maybe down the line including the microbiome in your studies, as there, you know, has a lot of implications in obesity and nutrition as well.
What a great question. Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned it because I meant to and skipped over it. The microbiome, everybody sort of know what we're talking. No, let me explain.
No.
This is basically all of the organisms, the microbes that live on us, on our skin, in our mouth, in our nose, or in us, in our GI tract. And it's pretty astounding once you start taking account of that and just what an enormous contribution that makes to our own health. There are more microbes, if you count up the cells, than there are our cells. They've got us outnumbered. And it's pretty clear that we are not just an organism, we're a superorganism. And if there is a derangement or a mismatch of the microbes in ourselves, that's capable of causing problems with health. Now, we've known about microbes being there. The advance has been that we are now able to take a full census of them because they have DNA, too. So we can do this DNA analysis and figure out what's there. Even though those are microbes we couldn't grow in the laboratory, we now know about them. And it's amazing once you have that opportunity, and this has just come along the last 4 or 5 years, to see what the correlations are with obesity. It's pretty interesting, both in mice and in people, that there's something about the microbes in the GI tract that has a big role in whether somebody is struggling to maintain the weight or whether it's easy for them. They also seem to be playing a role in disorders of the brain. Now, that really surprises you, but those microbes are carrying out their own kind of metabolism, and their metabolism is therefore contributing to your metabolism, and a good match is a good thing, and a bad match can make you sick. So we definitely want to include microbiome analysis in this million-strong set of individuals, because I know we're going to learn things about cause and effect that we didn't know before.
Right. Okay. Question, let's see, right here, this woman right here in the middle.
You spent a lot of time talking about diseases of adults or the elderly, but precision medicine, once we understand diseases in that age group, has the ability to really impact how we think about children and
yes.
The true potential of preventing disease. Could you comment about that?
Glad you asked. Absolutely. And we do intend to include children in this initiative, although there was a big debate about that, given the fact that there are perhaps more vulnerabilities and how do you do the consent process, and we'll have to be very clear about how we handle that. But you're right. So much of adult chronic illness seems to be in some way connected both with childhood health, but even with prenatal health in terms of what happens in utero. The whole increasing evidence that, for instance, adult diabetes is connected with things that happen while one is still unborn. And we need to understand that better. And again, if we have this number of individuals, and some of them are kids, and some of them are women who get pregnant, so we can actually collect information about what's happening during the pregnancy, environmental exposures, and so on, we should be able to learn more about that. And yeah, we should think of health not as something that happens when you're 32, but it's happening your whole continuous life experience.
But the consent question is
a
really
interesting
one. The consent
question is going to be more complicated.
Okay, way over there in the corner, and then we'll work our way back.
So when we're looking at healthy people and following them up for later health outcomes, obviously things like medical records, microbiome analysis, whatever you get from wearable devices, that's very objective data. But when it comes to lifestyle, diet, environmental exposures, that's obviously quite subjective. And a good example would be NHANES, which has spent decades looking at dietary intake and later disease outcomes. But when you actually look at the NHANES data, there's so much underreporting that actually we don't really know what people are eating. Maybe 30, 40, 50% is underreported. So in this million-strong group of people, how do you fix that problem when, you know, I just ate a lot of peanut butter cookies outside, but maybe I don't want to tell you about that. So how do you fix that and stop that sort of subjective nature creeping in?
Oh, I'm totally there with you, because we sure don't want to continue using the same old dietary questionnaires that have been the mainstay of this kind of research, and which we know are incredibly flawed in terms of people's recall And it's not just sort of forgetting, it's also sort of biased by people don't want to admit the things they did. Yeah, I had two or three of those. They were pretty good too, but I'm not sure I would have reported it, except you just brought it up. So there, and this is a good example where technology has got to come into this space in a way that it hasn't been. I mean, pen and paper questionnaires, we got to do better than that. Again, there are people now developing cell phone abilities where when you are going to eat something, you take a picture of it. And that gets basically digitized and immediately calculated what the caloric count was. In the most elaborate version, you take a picture of it before and you take a picture of it after to see if there's anything left. And then you do the quick analysis. And we actually have some programs that are starting to do that. I mentioned a little bit ago about exercise. Likewise, people are prone of reporting that they do a lot more exercising than they actually do. We have now very good ways with gadgets like this to be able to get that in objective terms. That, I think, is actually one of the exciting aspects of this cohort, is to sort of throw out the sloppy stuff that we've done before because it was the best we could and try to do this in a more rigorous digital way.
That's fascinating. Okay, right back there. We've got about four hands here. Yeah.
So with the evolution of nanotechnology and this concept that I think I've heard of with, you know, smart nanobots actually being released into the body to go target some of these things, that seems like some type of precision medicine, but is that just like, just, you know, way out there on the horizon relative to the benefit that could provide with targeted medicine versus, you know, just developing this longer list of drugs that are basically genetic-based?
It's all part of, I think, this same exciting landscape of opportunity. We talked this morning about bioelectronic medicines, where you try to take advantage of what the nervous system already knows how to do in terms of keeping the body healthy, but sometimes doesn't work the way you want it to. Whether it's nanotechnology, where you're trying to engineer little nanorobots that will go to the right part of the body and deliver something so that the rest of the body doesn't get exposed to it. I have to mention an area that I think is enormously exciting, which is beginning also to get into this precision medicine space, and that's the ability to use stem cells that we can derive from any of you, take a simple skin biopsy, grow the cells out of that skin biopsy, add the magic four genes that Shinya Yamanaka discovered a few years ago. Those cells then go back in time, and they become what we call pluripotent. They're immortal, and they can become any tissue that you might need if you give them the right cocktail of various signals to tell them, oh, okay, I want you to be a liver now, or a kidney now, or a brain cell. This has all happened in the space of the last few years. And, of course, they're your cells. Now imagine if you wanted to know whether for you a particular drug that you need for treating your kidney disease was actually going to help you or not. Wouldn't it be cool if you actually had a little model of your own kidney and you could try it out? Well, this is in fact a kidney. This is a human kidney, which has been put together in exactly that way, taking these kinds of cells, and in this case, it has both the kidney cells, it has the blood cells, so that you can actually imagine the various parts of this, and it's not just cells growing flat on a surface. These are three-dimensional. We call them organoids because they're closer and closer to organs. I have a blood-brain barrier here, too, if you want to look at that, because it's got both the blood channels, and it has neurons, and it has glia, sort of the cells that hold the whole thing together. And these are human cells that are happily there in a three-dimensional arrangement that you can use to try out all kinds of things before you have to try them on a person and put them at risk. So if you want to think a little bit, or maybe a lot, downstream, for all of us, when you're trying to figure out what would be the best way for you to be treated for a particular condition or to stay healthy, to have your own collection of organoids that represent you, that these kinds of things could be tested on, would be pretty powerful. We're a long way from being able to do that exactly now, but you can kind of see the path.
Very cool. All right, we are almost
at
the end.
Have I freaked you out yet?
Let's see. In the back, and then this lady in yellow, and if we have time, we'll come to the front. Yes.
I think the PMI is very exciting, especially because you're thinking of a large cohort naturalistic deployment, and you'll likely get repeated measurements. The question that I want to ask is, you know, FDA approves, think about some of the technologies that you're wearing on your wrist, so measures of, say, physiology, and then they lock in innovation or development of those devices. So not a lot of people wear them, but you have very precise measurement. Now you've got consumer devices where everybody is wearing them, like the ones that you have, but they're not scientifically validated. Is there a discussion happening around, what's the ratio of precision versus the amount of data you have? How much noise are you willing to deal with?
Good question.
1 minute.
Great question. No, FDA is, I think, intensely interested in how to hit the sweet spot there, not to squash innovation because there's so much happening in these wearable sensors, but if they are going to actually become something that is used for managing a disease, so for instance, if you have a cell phone-based effort that's telling you how much insulin you need to give, you probably want to be sure that that one has been carefully tested. And it's not an easy sweet spot to find, but I think they're working intensively on it. So I would have some hopes for that.
Okay, we've got about 1 minute left, so we're going to try to squeeze in your question. Go ahead.
I'll be quick, I promise. Hi, I'm very excited about the Precision Medicine Initiative. So I'm at Genentech, and just in our organization and our industry, we're getting such an increased amount and scope of real-world data. So the PMI is going to be adding a whole new layer. So my question is around the analytic technologies and machine learning technologies. I feel like those would be essential to something like this. What's going to be the strategy, or how are you going to bake that into the initiative?
That's another great question. I say to young people who are interested in biomedical research, if you really want to build your skill set in a particular field, build it in computational biology, because that's where an awful lot of the excitement is now going to be. We're going to have these enormous, complex data sets, and there's a lot of truth in there, and there's also some noise. You mentioned how much noise can we tolerate. You can tolerate a fair amount of noise if you have a huge data set, but there's limits there. So I think, basically, NIH has this big investment, which we didn't talk about, but which is actually very much connected here, called Big Data to Knowledge, BD2K. Which is trying to move our field of biomedicine into this big data space, which, you know, the physicists have been there for a while, and the cosmologists and the weather people, but we're suddenly emerging as the biggest kids of all with the kinds of data that's going to be produced here. And we need to be sure that we have the talented folks to write those algorithms, to develop the software, to make sure it's distributable, to figure out where to store the data so people can find it who are supposed to find it, to have the standards. All of those things need a lot of work. The good news is people get that. It's not just sitting there unattended. The tough news is we have to move fast here to keep up with the data itself, which is just mushrooming in size. And we don't want it to just sit there. We want to learn from it.
So are more young people going into the
you know, it's
described?
A good thing that, in fact, I think this current generation that's coming up through middle school and high school and college are in much more sophisticated about computational approaches to everything. They certainly run circles around me telling me what apps I need for my watch. And I think we need them not to sort of walk away from that like, oh, that's what I did when I was a kid, but to embrace it and to say, that's going to be my career. And it'll be a lot of fun, too.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. Let's thank Dr. Collins, Francis Collins, for a great explanation. It's great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. From Bench to Bedside, How Precision Medicine is Changing the Future. You can access this discussion and all of our Ideas Festival coverage online, aspenpublicradio.org. Thanks for listening. Corporate support for Aspen Public Radio's coverage of the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival broadcasts comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations with offices in Aspen and Denver. More at obermeyerwood.com.